Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, you know the story. The spouse accused of murder denies everything and says, must have been some strange intruder. And then the family and the friends take up sides. You know, it sounds like the Peterson case over in Durham, or going back to O.J. Simpson and that case, or Jeffrey McDonald, the special forces doctor who found an intruder, or who said there was an intruder who murdered his wife and children. And somehow or another, we always think, oh, gosh, how could they make up a story about like that? And then we start to wonder, you know, well, maybe, possibly. But, well, there's another story that has been put together by a UNC Law School professor and her husband, and Professor Patricia Bryan of the University of North Carolina School of Law. Your and your husband's book, Midnight Assassin, has some of the elements of this same story, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. A woman accused of killing her husband, and she and all her children. She had 9 children. They had been married for 33 years, claimed that she was innocent. So,
But this is not quite as modern as these others. This is more than 100 years old now.
1900, December 1900, on an isolated Iowa farm, a very small farmhouse. 5 children lived with Margaret and John Hossack. And the children were awakened in the middle of the night by Margaret Hossack, who called up to them saying she thought someone was in the house and something had happened to Pa. They ran down. She took them into the bedroom. It was actually the bedroom that the two of them shared, a very small bed. It was what they called then a three-quarters bed. So the two of them were sleeping very close.
This is smaller than a double bed.
Not a full, not a
queen
king,
size.
Not a queen, right.
Not a double,
not
but
a
less
double.
Than a double.
Yes, and these were not small people. But her story, and she told her children this right away, was that she had slept through the attack. She had woken, she said, to the sound of something that sounded like 2 boards being hit together. She heard, she got up, she went out, she heard her husband groaning, she said. She called to her children, they went out, they went back in the bedroom, and there he lay. He had been hit in the head with an axe. It was quite a brutal attack. He was hit once with a sharp end and then hit again with the blunt end. He lived, surprisingly, for about 10 hours after he was struck. And neighbors came to the house. A doctor was called. Margaret Hossack, his wife, sat by him and held his hand, gave him water, wiped his forehead. But there was nothing that anyone could do. He died that morning, Sunday morning. He didn't say anything about the identity of his attacker. He talked a little bit, but he couldn't make much sense. He went in and out of consciousness. So he never, whether he had any idea what had happened to him, who had done it, unclear.
Well, what were the different ideas that developed early on about how, what the possibilities were for what happened?
Well, the next day, about that afternoon, the sheriff and the coroner and the sheriff's deputy arrived, and they started to investigate. And there was circumstantial evidence right away which pointed to someone in the family. They found the axe, the family axe, underneath the granary where they kept corn and coal, underneath the granary. And it was definitely the family axe, and it had what looked like blood and hairs on it. Now, it was handled so many times. You know, they found it, they pulled it out, they touched the blade, they threw it back under, they took it out again. It was compromised as evidence by the time they protected
it. It was, quote, obvious to them that this was the murder weapon. Whether it was or not, it was obvious to them.
Yes, and the fact that the family axe had been used, the younger son said he had put the family axe away inside the granary. So it had been moved, which suggested perhaps an intruder had gotten it. On the other hand, the authorities suspected an insider right away, a member of the family, because who else would use the family axe? There was also the case that the dog did not bark. And the dog was known to be a very aggressive, very lively dog, and none of the children heard the dog bark. Now, the defense later said, well, the dog had been drugged. That was never proven. But
it was my dog don't bark when you come around that door. It was that the dog was surrounded by familiar people rather than a stranger intruder.
There was no sign of an intruder. Mr. Hossack had his wallet next to the bed. That was not taken. Everything was undisturbed. There was certainly no sign of a break-in. Now, they didn't lock the door. Also, I think what led the authorities most of all to Mrs. Hossack was as they talked to the neighbors in the yard, standing around while they're doing the investigation, they started hearing stories that the family had not been happy. There had been Mrs. Hossack for years, really going back 15 years, had, as the sheriff and the lawyers eventually put it, had been complaining about her husband. Now, she had been telling the neighbors that she was afraid of him, that he threatened her and the children with guns and knives. She was afraid that he might hurt one of them. Apparently, he had a very violent temper. I mean, it's interesting because there was no sign or no report that he had physically harmed any of them. On the other hand, if that had been the case, would they have talked about it? You know, we don't know.
Mm. It's an insight into family management and life 100 years ago and to a certain extent today.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, families today, when there's abuse, often don't like to talk about it. And Margaret Hossack had gone to her neighbors when she felt especially afraid. It's interesting because they really hadn't done anything to help her. Now, you have to think, what might they have done? She pleaded with them not to tell her husband that she was talking to them. So it wasn't as if they could come and take him away. They talked about the possibility of arresting him or having him committed to the insane asylum. That was something that was done more frequently then than now. But he was a very well-respected farmer and community leader. And doing either of those things, arresting, committing to the insane asylum, were really unthinkable for a man of his stature. So basically, the neighbors and Margaret Hossack primarily talked to the male neighbors, John Hossack's friends, because they were the ones who might have been able to do something to help her. They told her not to worry, that they talked among themselves about whether there was cause, whether there was danger, but they assured her they didn't think he would do any harm. At one point, about a year before the murder, she had run away, gone to a neighbor's house. He had taken her home and convinced the couple to reconcile. And after that, she didn't talk so much to the neighbors. Of course, the neighbors had told her, don't talk about family matters. You know, family matters are private matters. We don't want to hear from you anymore. So whether there was a peace achieved or not, we'll never know.
Well, as you point out so well in your book, this was kind of a catch-22 for Margaret Hossack. The possible abuse or possible strained relationships, or maybe even worse, that would develop sympathy for her if she were the murderer. She couldn't talk about that on the advice of her lawyer because that was the big evidence that the prosecution had that she had a motive to kill.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's so ironic, isn't it? Because just exactly as you say, the very evidence that might have been seen as extenuating circumstances or provoked some kind of empathic reaction was seen as a motive. Now, it's a little bit, I mean, it's interesting because Margaret Hossack from the beginning claimed that she did not do it. So the defense couldn't have argued here battered wife. You know, they couldn't argue there were extenuating circumstances which caused her to murder because she said she didn't murder. And in fact, we have the transcript from the coroner's inquest, which was 2 days, or actually her testimony came 2 days, but it started the very day after the murder. They held the coroner's inquest in the farmhouse, in the sitting room where John Hossack's body still lay in the bedroom. And the Hossack family were all kept isolated upstairs under guard, so they couldn't talk among themselves. But we have the transcript, and I've read, of course, Margaret Hossack's testimony, and she would not even admit that she had talked to the neighbors, that there were troubles between herself and her husband. You know, the questioners are incredulous. They keep saying, "Why don't you tell us the truth?" And she said, "I hope you don't think I killed my husband. I loved him too much." Now, whether she understood that talking about the abuse would be seen as a motive, or whether, you know, as you were saying, that norm of family privacy, she didn't really want to admit, especially now that he was dead. Mm. Mm. But it's really a sad...
Well, we're not nearly through talking about this book, Midnight Assassin, written by UNC law professor Patricia Bryan and her husband, Thomas Wolfe. She and I'll be right back.
This is Gerald Ramoyne, General Manager of Performance Automall. Over the years, you've heard me talk about how proud we are to be a sponsor of WCHL's Village Pride Awards and about the great work we do in our sales and service departments. But nobody can describe our passion and commitment better than our employees. The people at Performance arrive each day committed to a special relationship with you, our neighbor.
My name's Mike Self. I've been here 14 years, and I love it. I've done about everything here, from parking cars to Chevrolet Technician of the Year, and I've done a little bit of everything here. We all strive for the same goal, being number one. First appearance is my main thing. You know, when they pull in here, I want it to look world-class and make them feel like, you know, they're getting the best of service. Performance can't be beat.
I couldn't have said it better. Every day, we try to earn the right to be your car dealer as well as your neighbor, and when we say performance can't be beat, we mean it.
Think, reflect, engage, learn. One pleasure of living in Chapel Hill is the opportunity for lifelong learning. Among the best are Adventures in Ideas weekend seminars, brought to you by your friends in the UNC Humanities program. Adventures in Ideas seminars take journeys of the mind and the imagination. Visit the early days of the Republic with Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, valuable 200 years ago and today. Get the lowdown on the New Deal. Illuminate the Dark Ages. Come see the Golden State, California in fiction, poetry, and film. Rediscover books that changed the world. Reread Charles Darwin, Rachel Carson, Betty Friedan. Understand the contemporary meanings of Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and Hindu fundamentalism. Stand at the European crossroads of old ethnicities and new economies. Think, reflect, engage, learn. Visit adventuresinideas.unc.edu. Join the UNC Humanities program this weekend for an Adventures in Ideas seminar. That's adventuresinideas.unc.edu.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Patricia Bryan, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School, but also the author, along with her husband, a very important book published by Algonquin Books here in Chapel Hill called Midnight Assassin. It's gotten great reviews, and it is, I can testify, a very well-written and stimulating book. And it's always more stimulating when you're dealing with murder, I guess. Patricia Bryan, this is maybe not the most fun thing to write about, but it does bring interest on, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And in fact, one of the most interesting things to us was talking to people in the community today and understanding how, well, the interest in a murder doesn't end with the deaths of the person who was convicted of the murder. I mean, it lives on. And especially when you never know for sure what happened. I mean, you continue to sort of go through in your mind certain hypotheses, and people in the community still argue over whether she did it, whether there was an intruder, what happened.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. And you obviously can put on both hats, as you've done in your book. Tell us the prosecuting attorney became, I don't want to say personally involved, but he came to a deep conviction that she was guilty. And what were the factors that so convinced him that he had no doubt that it was Margaret Hussack who killed her husband?
Well, you're right. He did seem to become somewhat personally involved. I think one factor was that he was a fairly young lawyer. He was up against a defense attorney who was much more senior than he. And George Clamor, the prosecutor, this was his first murder trial. And it was a time at the turn of the century where people were somewhat unsure whether the law could do its job. I mean, there were still lynchings.
Hard to get a conviction, so yeah. There were Rough Riders, vigilantes who enforced the law that the system didn't. So he
wanted to prove himself. He was a very aggressive, a very ambitious man. I'm not saying that he didn't believe that she was guilty, but he also was very eager to win the case. He claims in interviews that he was convinced from the beginning that her story did not make sense. And the evidence is, I mean, certainly there was a circumstantial evidence, the fact of the dog not barking, the family axe being the weapon. But there were also aspects of her behavior that he thought did not make sense. One thing specifically he said was that when she heard a noise, she hadn't, by her own testimony, turned to her husband to ask for help. She had run up to get her children. And as he argued to the jury, what kind of woman would do that, not turn to her husband immediately for protection? Also, and I think the jury bought this argument, her story about sleeping through the attack is hard to buy. You know, as we said before, it's a very small bed. He was sleeping next to the wall. So someone had to reach over her with the axe to hit him twice. The person, if it was an outside intruder, would have had to be, was very close to her. And does that make sense that she wouldn't have woken? Now, as the prosecutor said, either she's lying and she was awake or did it herself, or, as he said to the jury, if she didn't wake up, what kind of a mother is that? So, you know, the prosecutor's main evidence, of course, was motive. This history of Margaret Hossack's fears of her husband, and his point was, who else had a better motive to kill him?
Let me ask you this, because I think this goes to the heart of what the prosecutor, believed, and that was that this axe blow that opened up the skull of Mr. Hossack could not have been delivered without waking up Margaret Hossack. On the other hand, there are difficulties in understanding how Margaret Hossack could have, in the middle of the night, gone down, got the axe, brought it back up. I don't want to be sexist. I don't want to be accused of being more sexist than I am, but delivering a blow in the dark to a small target, at least for me, is kind of trouble. And I think here's some poor old woman trying to knock open a skull with an axe is a challenge anyway. I mean, was there any worry about those aspects in terms of saying that she couldn't have been the person who did this?
Well, of course, the prosecutor claimed just what you're saying, that it would not have been possible to make the blows so perfectly, you know, so close on target, so on his head, so exactly, without a light. So there had to be a light, and the light would have woken her up, or she did it herself. The point about the strength is an interesting one, because she was a large woman. She was about 160 pounds and tall. And, of course, she was a farm woman. So she claimed that she did not use the axe. She left the chopping up to her sons. But one of the neighbors testified that he had seen her use an axe, and she was very handy with an axe. So, you know, she certainly wasn't the frail, weak, crying kind of woman that might have been better for the defense in making the argument, you know, a woman never could have committed this kind of murder.
She was just, unfortunately, she was a woman, but she was a big woman.
She was a farm woman, you know. She was used to doing those hard tasks.
She might have been supposed to call on her husband to help when there was a noise in the dark, but she was perfectly able
to do it herself.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing. I want to talk about some of the really remarkable other things that come out of this book. But to kind of wrap it up, what happened when this thing went to trial?
Well, the prosecutor had a strong case. Actually, Susan Glaspell, well, we haven't talked about Susan Glaspell yet, but we will. Susan Glaspell was one of the reporters, and
now, who is Susan Glaspell outside of this?
Right. Susan Glaspell wrote a short story, A Jury of Her Peers, and a play, Trifles. And actually, those two were the genesis of my interest. I teach a law and literature seminar, and I came to this case through reading those fictional recreations. And I found Susan Glaspell, a memoir by her, saying that she was inspired to write these fictional pieces by a criminal case she had reported on in Iowa, 1900, for the Des Moines Daily News. Now, during the trial, she was a reporter, and she and other reporters were picked up on the prosecution's portrayal of Margaret Hossack as a very masculine woman who didn't seem to be overly sad about her husband's death. And of course, if the stories of abuse were true, she may well not have been. She wasn't seen to cry, to be very emotional. So the community sort of accepted the prosecution's portrayal. The defense tried to show and tried to argue that Margaret Hossack was an obedient wife, that she and her husband had reconciled, that she had no motive, that she had stayed by him while he was dying. They argued against the circumstantial evidence. And it's true that the blood and the hairs that had been found on the axe were never conclusively proved to be human blood or human hairs. So whether it was the murder weapon was never definitive. But the motive was the prosecution's big case, and the fact that there was nobody else who was really a suspect. And the jury, after just a few hours of deliberation, accepted the prosecution's arguments and convicted her.
Well, in fact, I think you reported that the jury sat around after they'd finished deliberating just because
let
they
some
were finished.
Time pass. Yeah.
But nevertheless, I was struck by, at least in the initial vote, there were a number of jurors who voted not guilty on the and how do you explain that, plus the quick way that it was disposed, that it didn't take them long to convince the others?
Well, we don't really know much about the deliberations of the first trial. There was a second trial, and the second trial, there were clearly some jurors who were convinced that she was not guilty. I think the men, they were all men on the jury, who might have initially thought that she was not guilty in the first trial, were fairly quickly convinced to go along with the guilty verdict. And again, I think in part it was because the defense had no other suspects to bring forth. You know, of course, some people thought it might have been a son, but the main son who might have been a suspect had a fairly strong alibi.
Well, we're talking about the complexities of one of these cases of a murder in which the spouse is accused of committing the murder, and then the alibi or the possibility is raised of some kind of intruder. But this is set in Iowa more than 100 years ago, and the poor wife is charged with murder, now found guilty. We're talking to Patricia Bryan about her book about this case, and we'll be right back.
This is Jerry Hatfield Meringue, and when you listen to Woody, I want you to hear every exciting moment of Tar Heel basketball. If you or someone you know has a hearing loss, call Hatfield Meringue Hearing Aid Centers. We have a location near you in the Glen Lennox Shopping Center, Chapel Hill, and one on Broad Street in Durham.
Long outside shot, short rebounded. May, it's over! Carolina has won the national championship!
At Hatfield Meringue, we want you to hear all of life's precious sounds.
Nothing says you care more than flowers. This Valentine's Day, bring home something special. Unique or traditional, University Florist and Botanica have it all. Put a twist on an old favorite. We specialize in many colors of roses, and our professional staff can turn our fresh-cut flowers into a one-of-a-kind arrangement for your sweetheart. Visit University Florist today at 124 East Franklin Street or Botanica at University Square. No matter which shop you choose, you will always find just the right flower, gift, or expression of feelings.
And now, here's Deborah Miller from A Southern Season.
From our legendary Tar Heels to our incomparable quality of life, our hometown pride is evident at every turn. Named one of America's outstanding retailers at the International Fancy Food Show, we're bursting at the seams with award-winning gifts of good taste, glorious flavors, and gustatory delights. Our family of customers extends far and wide, but we wouldn't even think of calling anywhere else home.
A Southern Season, Chapel Hill's landmark gourmet emporium at University Mall.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360, WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Patricia Bryan, a law school professor at Carolina, and her husband, Thomas Wolfe, have written an incredible book called Midnight Assassin, which is about a murder and about the resolution of the murder. The wife is accused, and she stood trial, found guilty in the first in her trial, and goes to prison.
Right.
But what happens?
Well, she went to prison, imprisoned for life, sentenced to hard labor. Now, the truth was, Anamosa Penitentiary, where she was sent, I'm not sure it was as hard labor as what she had lived through on the farm.
Sounded like heaven compared
to
the farm.
Yeah, right.
Somebody else is cooking the meal. Somebody else is doing all the chores.
Right. Running water, light.
There's a library to go to church every Sunday, and
exactly.
No men to bother.
You're surrounded by other women. She missed her children. I mean, it was a difficult time for her. Her children visited her. One of the things that was interesting, though, was that almost immediately after she was convicted, the community sentiment started to change. And whether it was because they reacted to the speed with which the jury decided, whether all of a sudden, now that she was guilty and sent away, they started reevaluating, was she a danger to the community, or whether, as we posit, perhaps they started to reevaluate their own role and their own moral culpability in a way. They knew.
Yeah, explain that a little bit.
Well, they knew there was a dangerous situation at the farm.
Oh, that they had not intervened as she requested.
They had not done anything to help. Right. And certainly they had testified against her. And by that I only mean they had testified to these conversations with her. But the community had been certain she was guilty. But once she was sent away, there were petitions which went through the community with people signing, asking that she be paroled. Now, within a year, she was not paroled, but the conviction was reversed. It went up to the Supreme Court. Her lawyers appealed. The Iowa Supreme Court found that there had been certain evidence, specifically the hairs on the axe that had been improperly admitted, and other parts of the trial.
There were two things that were of great interest to me because now murder trials have gotten so complicated with DNA and with all kinds of that. But these were legal issues that I could still understand and could also understand that they were, you know, kind of funny issues. One was, as you mentioned, the axe and the sort of chain of custody about the so-called human hairs and whether this is something that lawyers would get involved in. And so that evidence had been allowed, and the appellate court said probably not, and that was crucial.
Right.
The other was this complicated issue about whether or not the evidence of the couple's disagreements and complaints in the community should be allowed as evidence of to prove her motive.
Right.
And as you explained the rule in your book, it was that if the couple, under Iowa law at the time, if the couple had actually reconciled, then the history of disagreements before the reconciliation were should not be admitted or should not be considered. And if any evidence of after the reconciliation would be admissible, but first you had to prove the reconciliation. So it got to be a very complicated legal issue and a question of whether the judge made the decision or the jury made the decision. Anyway, all of this was kind of an interesting way to teach legal theory. And could anybody else other than a lawyer have written this book?
I don't know, but I'm impressed it came through so clearly. That's a complicated issue.
Well, it's – I mean, it's – I just say it's a tribute to you, and maybe I'm – you know, not – it's questionable whether I can still call myself a lawyer, but I think that the one of the things about books that makes us that makes them so wonderful is not just the story that goes along with it, but the learning that takes place interwoven into the story. And y'all did a good job with that.
Thank you.
All right, so Shiki's in any event, sorry for my
I appreciate it.
Getting back to the story, so she got a second trial, and what happened in the second trial?
Well, the second trial was, of course, quite a bit later, 2 years. Well, a year and a half from the date of the murder. So feelings had, you know, subsided a bit. It was also in a different county. The defense moved for a change of venue. It was granted. So it was in Winterset County, which was a neighboring county. Now, part of the result of that was that the jury members, perhaps because of the passage of time, they hadn't been neighbors of the Hossacks, hadn't formed their views prior to sitting on that jury. Of course, the first jury member said they hadn't either, but that's, you know, you wonder. The second jury, some of them in the community hadn't heard or didn't remember so well John Hossack. Certainly, he didn't come through at the second trial as the same kind of leader of the community, the same stature as in the first. Mm-hmm. The other thing does go to that reconciliation point. Because the reconciliation was much more important, Margaret Hossack was asked more questions about her marriage than she was at the first. Not a lot, but she did claim under oath that they had reconciled and that there had not been troubles between them. And, of course, the story of the family troubles wasn't so prevalent in this second community as it had been at the first. And Margaret Hossack was a frail, older woman who had been in prison for a year. And I think, and her children surrounded her at every juncture during this trial. And I think the image of her with her children and the less prominent image of John Hossack changed the sympathies of the community and the jury. Of course, it was still true that a majority of the jury wanted to find her guilty. One other thing I'll say is that the defense maybe learned its lesson from the first trial, and they did come up with several possibilities for other suspects.
Got somebody else to chase.
They talked about a mysterious horseman, and they found a neighbor who testified that he had seen a horse with a mysterious horseman driving by. Never been found. So there were a couple of, you know, if she didn't do it, well, maybe it was someone who was never discovered.
Well, and then what happened?
Well, it was a hung jury, so that Margaret Hossack could have been tried again, but was not.
Everybody was tired.
Yeah, the prosecutor, Warren County said they weren't going to spend any more money on the case, even though the county attorney said, I still feel she's guilty. They admitted that they probably wouldn't be able to convict
her.
Just
in a word or two, what happened to Margaret Hossack, this once convicted criminal murderer and murderess, and then not found not guilty? How could she do?
She went back to her community. She lived in a rooming house with one of her sons, a son never married, and she was very quiet, never spoke, as far as we know, of the murder. We did talk to one of her grandchildren, who was elderly at the time we talked to her, but remembered her grandmother. Actually, we talked to the grandmother's, the grandchild's child, who said that, you know, Margaret Hossack seemed very withdrawn. But she did go back to the community, which is striking.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, listen, let's take another break. Patricia Bryan is telling us about her book, the one that she wrote with her husband, Thomas Wolfe, called Midnight Assassin. And she and I will be right back.
WCHL 1360. Time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins. Brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners Community.
He was swallowed by a giant snake and a groaner of a movie. It wasn't pleasant, but it got him noticed. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Hey, Coach Jimmy Johnson, what are you doing at Sam's Club?
Stocking up for my big game party. I got this 50-inch high-definition plasma TV, buffalo hot wings, party trays, and 10 bags of Tostitos.
Tostitos? I'm going long. Throw me a bag.
I don't think so.
Aisle 15, I'm open.
Somebody get a stretcher. That's gotta hurt.
Sam's Club. Everything you need for great big game memories is here. So stock up and save big on great food items, electronics, and more. 10% service fee applies to all non-member purchases.
As a boy, he terrorized his Texas neighborhood. He was the middle boy of three brothers, and the worst behaved of all of them. When he stole his teacher's math book, his Dallas high school expelled him. Military school did little to change his roguish, laid-back manner, but in college, he got serious. He penned a short film with a friend, and without a single acting lesson, took on the lead. The film, Bottle Rocket, showed at the Sundance Film Festival and was soon turned into a full-length feature. The blonde actor with a crooked nose, broken three times from playing football, landed small parts in The Cable Guy and Anaconda. Playing alongside Jackie Chan in Shanghai Noon, he won more than his share of laughs. He could also write. The screenplay for The Royal Tenenbaums, which he co-wrote, was nominated for an Academy Award. The former boyfriend of Sheryl Crow made a splash co-starring with Ben Stiller in Starsky and Hutch. When Wedding Crashers came out, his face was plastered across the nation, leaving few who didn't recognize Hollywood star Owen Wilson. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. UNC Law Professor Patricia Bryan and her husband Thomas Wolfe have written a book called Midnight Assassin, and it's about a murder out in Iowa 100 and some years ago. Interwoven, not just the story of the murder, which is, you know, engaging enough by itself, but this is more, Patricia Bryan, than just a murder mystery. It's a whole sociological study of the way people were living back then 100 years ago. And you clearly set out to share with us a way of life that's quite different from modern life in some respects and similar in others. What did you set out to teach us in that regard?
Oh, well, one of the most interesting parts of our research was just trying to imagine what it was like for these people on these farms, and especially for women who were so isolated and just enormously overworked. You know, their tasks were not seen as having much economic significance. They didn't go to town the way the men did to buy and sell. They were basically at home doing fairly thankless tasks, trying to keep, you know, the dung and the insects out of the home, dealing with
children.
No
vacuum cleaners.
No dustbuster.
No.
Yeah. Margaret Hossack, from the age of 24 until 44, had 10 children. Her last was at the age of 44. So she was, you know, the 20 years of her marriage, the first 20 years, she was mostly pregnant or with small children. Now, it's true that children, as they got older, helped with tasks more than my children do, but
shouldn't
still,
have said that.
Well,
you're going to pay for
still,
that.
she you know, had terrible, overwhelming responsibilities in the home. So we wanted to show what it was like for women at this time, and also the interactions among the neighbors was really fascinating to us. I think that resonates with people today. How does a community deal with what they know is a dangerous situation? And then, of course, the courtroom scenes, how stories are told in the courtroom, how the media portrays defendants and victims as lawyers do in, you know, trying to fit them into certain paradigms that come with certain assumptions and biases about how they behave, and how juries make decisions often based on those stereotypes.
You know, a lot of people say, well, what does Iowa have to do with North Carolina? And, I mean, that's a fair enough question. And my answer, and I don't know what answers you all have developed for that, in addition to people have similar traits all over the place, but these people that you described on the sort of edge of the semi-frontier, much like our mountain people, in all respects, and the fact that the Hossacks were both either immigrants from Scotland or first-generation Scottish immigrants raised in this great Presbyterian church and tradition, but hard scrabble and having to make it on the farm could have been set almost in a North Carolina mountain county, couldn't it?
Oh, yes. In fact, we've been interested, as we've talked about the book, in North Carolina and other states as well, how many people connect to, you know, if it's not a farm where they're growing hogs or raising hogs and corn, just the isolated, difficult life that people led. So I think that's very true. And how families stick together, you know, and the interplay of relationships among family and neighbors and communities, I think is true even today to a certain extent in many small towns.
Well, there was another aspect that was interesting for me as a kind of male head of household, quote, head of household figure, that the just as in the racial situation where the liberation of blacks has really freed white people to be something different and better, that the change in relationships in the domestic life that have come about and are developing, I had a hard time. I really sympathized with the men in this situation in the kind of life that they had to lead, you know, being in charge, keeping everything in order, and in fact required to be oppressive in some respects in order to be sort of, you know, in order to be what they were supposed to be.
Sure.
And I thought, my golly, thank goodness that I didn't, not only did I not have to be a woman in those times, but that I didn't have to be a man in those times.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I would also just add, I think that it's not unlikely that John Hossack, as other people in this time and place, had some aspects of mental illness that were not treated. You know, I mean, he led a very difficult life.
Well, you all point out in the book that there is an incidence of mental illness and how you describe it. And the question kept coming back to me is this mental illness, as it's described in the book, is this something that is just they're just not getting the treatment because of where they live, or the way that they're living. Is it the way that they're living that is driving them to kind of an emotional instability, that having to be hard or accept this hard discipline kind of leads you to?
Oh, I think there's definitely a combination. I think that's, you know, as you say, it wasn't easy being a man in these times.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had very difficult tasks, saw himself as the head of this family. His boys, as they grew, were rebelling against him. He felt it important to sort of stand there as his firm authority figure. And I think, you know, today, would it have been diagnosed? Would it have even come about? I mean, certainly there are changes.
You've probably gotten some help or I don't know. Well, anyway, all right, now we just got a minute. And in your classes in the law school, you let your students debate this.
Yes.
And where do the majority usually come down? Did she do it or didn't she?
Oh, I would say the majority come down thinking that the son probably did it.
Oh, is that
Margaret
right?
Hossack was, and I don't know. I mean, I go back and forth.
I'm not
the
asking
son,
you. I'm not
right,
asking.
That there was sort of a maternal impulse to protect the son.
Well, thanks for sharing this with us. Now, if you hear this coming up on February 9th at Market Street Books and Maps in Southern Village at 7 p.m., Patricia Bryan and her husband Thomas Wolf will be talking about this really incredible, it's unusual and wonderful book, and will be, if you want to buy a copy or bring a copy, I bet you they'll sign it for you. And this will be the last time for a little while that they'll be appearing, but we hope we can get them to come back and talk to us about this great book sometime soon again. February 9th, 7 p.m. at Market Street Books and Maps in Southern Village.
Great.
And Patricia Bryan, thanks to you, and thanks to your husband, Thomas Wolf.
I've enjoyed it.
For all of the research and love and good writing that you put into this book.
Thank you very much.
Again, my guest has been Patricia Bryan, co-author of Midnight Assassin. And I want to thank all of y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
Now, here's news about the availability of high-quality professional office space at the campus on Vilcom Circle. A longtime tenant is moving away, and for the first time in a long time, you will find wonderful space in McClamrock Hall for your offices, up to 4,000 square feet. McClamrock Hall is the headquarters for Vilcom, owner of this Chapel Hill landmark building. McClamrock Hall offers free parking virtually at the door for staff and visitors, and is right across the street from a post office, restaurants, theaters, and shopping. You may occupy all or a portion of the space, and it can be configured to your need. This is an unusual vacancy that may not last long. If you are looking for more space or want to upgrade your offices, look now to McClamrock Hall and the campus on Vilcom Circle. Call Christy Jones at 968-4811. That's Christy Jones at 968-4811. Let us show you what is available and why we love working in McClamrock Hall at the campus on Vilcom Circle.
Hey, Tim. Man, you look exhausted. Long night?
To say the least, I had a bad dream. I took my clothes to one of those bargain cleaners. My pants were wrinkled, and they lost my favorite cobalt blue shirt. You know the one my mom bought me.
No!
No!
Tim.
No!
Tim, relax. It was just a dream. And besides, you take your clothes to Plaza Dry Cleaners, and you know Brenda takes care of your clothes.
You're right. I do.
This is Brenda Dye Honeycutt. At Plaza Dry Cleaners, trust that your clothes will receive the best in dry cleaning service. And with our Green Earth cleaning solvent, your clothes are not only cleaned, but cleaned with a solvent that will not harm your clothes or our environment.
Visit Brenda today at Plaza Dry Cleaners, 111 South Elliott Road in the Village Plaza Shopping Center. That's Plaza Dry Cleaners, where quality is our specialty.
You know that TV show Desperate Housewives? I've been wondering, just why are they so desperate? What's missing in their lives? As a certified diamond doctor, I think I've got the answer. Hi, I'm Berkeley Grimble of Grimble Jewelers, Chapel Hill Certified Diamond Doctor. After hours of rigorous analysis, I've come to the conclusion that they need bigger diamonds. I mean, take a look at them. Note the absence of large diamond studs. The void in their lives is so obvious, the pain they must feel when they look in the mirror. Let's banish desperation forever. Hope is just a short drive to Grimble Jewelers.
At home, at work, in the car. New